Hi everyone. As you may know, it is our mission to support and uplift Asian voices and stories in our community. And a huge part of this is normalizing conversations around mental health in Asian households. In episode 26 of The Potty, we had a super insightful convo with the delightful Asami, the founder behind Shapes and Sounds, which is the online destination and platform for Aussie Asian mental health and well-being.
So the next step of her project is creating a club to foster a safe community for us Aussie Asians, which I swear I've never ever seen this before. So it's like totally sick that we'll finally get to have a dedicated space for people like you and me to come together and talk about all of the hard and good stuff. It'll feature webinars with experts, access to personalized programs catered for our unique Asian diaspora experience, and also an opportunity to meet like-minded Australian Asians.
So sign up for the full 3-month trial from the end of April to July, and not only will you get the first month absolutely free, but also a cool Shapes and Sounds tote bag to go along with it.
For sure, that sounds sick. Anyway, if y'all interested, be sure to check out justshapesandsounds.com. So that's J-E-S-T, shapesandsounds.com. You can also find them on Instagram as well at justshapesandsounds. Tiana and I will definitely be on the platform as well, so we will see you guys there. Thank you to Shapes and Sounds for being an absolute pioneer in the Asian mental health space. This is something that we've been craving and something that we definitely need. So we're super excited to see how it's going to turn out. Anyway, back onto the episode.
Welcome to Unapologetically Asian, the place where we talk about navigating through adulthood as Asian Australians. Today you're joined by Tiana,
Twi,
and Rebecca.
Hi everyone, thank you for joining us. Today we have a lovely guest. We are joined by the amazing Rebecca Lim, an author, lawyer, and she also wears many, many different hats. Yeah, so today we're just going to jump straight into it, talk about, you know, who you are, how you've grown up, and all the amazing work that you've done so far.
Thanks for having me. It's just amazing to be here. I'm Rebecca Lim. I've been in Australia since the early 1970s, which is like the olden days to most people. Wanted to be a writer from about the age of 7. Started writing lots of short stories and poems, which are dreadful, and I've got boxes of those. went through school like every other Asian kid, told to study hard, told to really study hard, you know, do some instruments, do extra Chinese school, all that kind of stuff, and then ended up being a writer at the age of 32, but was a lawyer before that. So I took some time off from being a lawyer to just do some writing because I was fairly burnt out at that point. And I thought I'd probably give it 2 years, but I was lucky enough to get stuff published. So I took about 13 years off law and went back to the law after that. And I'm trying to juggle like a full-time job and, you know, other pursuits that, you know, really are the passion projects.
Thank you so much for telling us a bit about yourself. And you were talking about your immigration story and about growing up as an Asian Australian. Can you tell us a bit about what it was like at home and what it was like at school for you?
When I came, I probably would need regression therapy to actually remember what it was like living in rural Queensland, because I came as a toddler and we were sort of like, you know, in the middle of probably bacon making country. My dad was like one of the two doctors at the local base hospital. So he moved across to be a medical practitioner. And I think there was like one other Malaysian lady in the township where we lived, and that was about it. And she kind of taught my mum a few dishes to make because she was homesick, but it was really not a very Asian heavy environment at that point. And we kind of stuck that out for a couple of years, and then we moved down the east coast to Melbourne. Dad set up a sort of GP practice in the eastern suburbs in Melbourne, and pretty much had to navigate, I guess, speaking Mandarin and Hokkien and, you know, different kinds of dialects at home, all the strictness that, you know, being raised in a really traditional Asian family can sort of bring, as well as, you know, going to like school with white kids who had no idea what was in your lunchbox. Like, they just sort of looked at it with revulsion and thought, what is that thing? And it was just, I think the schools that I went to back then were pretty Caucasian. So like every other kid, I think in the 70s and 80s, like heaps of casual racism, you know, people thought it was hilarious. You kind of didn't really have much of a comeback because there weren't that many of you in the playground. And you just put up with it, I guess. I mean, I just noticed this morning there was like a story from this entertainer in the 80s called Kamal, who was Sri Lankan Indian, and how he just copped all this racism as part of his, you know, public persona, and had to put up with it because that was just normalized. Asians weren't really seen or heard unless they were the butt of a joke, or, you know, it was like some story on the media about boat people, because all of us were boat people, you know, that we were just like these massive Asians who could not be told apart. So, yeah, that was my experience pretty much.
As you said, there wasn't a lot of Asians around. Mm. You kind of, I guess, in a sense, feel a bit, you're alone, but you're not sure how to combat it because you want to also assimilate, or you want to feel a sense of belonging because it's your new home. Would you say that there were points where you kind of felt ashamed of being Asian, or were you largely still able to accept your identity, and were you proud of that?
I think it's really hard, especially for you know, kids in the 70s and 80s, where I guess there were less of us and there wasn't so much of a network. So, you know, if you wanted to see Asian faces, you'd have to go into Chinatown, or you'd have to go to Chinese school, because you were coming from all over the place and didn't necessarily get hooked into a suburb that was, you know, mostly Asian. I think you just kind of felt like you wanted to wake up one day and be blonde and blue-eyed and all your problems would just vanish overnight. So, you know, you'd see things like ABBA on TV, or, you know, all the ads at that point. Everyone was blonde, everyone was drinking soft drink, everyone was wearing bikinis standing on the beach. Nobody looked like you. And then when you read the books that they were giving you at school, nobody looked like you. And so there was like no, you know, positive role modeling about being Asian anywhere. So I think, you know, most of us just thought if we could just wake up and look like Agnetha from ABBA, life would be so much easier, because, you know, you just sort of had nowhere to fit in, and nothing about you was cool, and, you know, you just had no network, you had no sort of support thing to fall back on at school especially. So yeah, it wasn't a very positive period, I don't think, but, you know, you kind of get through it. And for most of us, I think, you know, you do sort of end up with pride about your cultural background, but you've got to kind of struggle through all this stuff to get there.
At what age in your life did you come to that acceptance of, you know, being completely and 100% proud of your cultural identity?
Maybe high school, because I think at that point, the high school I ended up with was still mostly Caucasian, but there were a lot of really funny first generation and second generation Chinese Australian girls who just sort of suddenly appeared. And so, you know, there weren't that many of us. Maybe there were like 10 to 15 of us, but all of a sudden there were other people like you around, and you could kind of like crack jokes and understand the context for things. So, you know, we weren't all necessarily from the same Asian backgrounds. Like, you know, some people spoke Cantonese, some people spoke other languages, but there was like a shared feeling that, you know, we'd been through similar things together and we could talk about it.
You grew up in a household where there was a big emphasis on studying hard, which I think a lot of people can relate to. Do you think that pressure was something that was just external, or do you think you had a bit of an internal pressure as well, because you understood that it is part of the Asian culture to put a large emphasis on education and working hard and succeeding?
Yeah, I think there's like, I mean, for a lot of Asian girls in particular, it's really tricky, because not only do we have to do as well as the boys do, but then, you know, when we get married and have families, we suddenly have to become these paragon Asian women. So I think, you know, for an Asian girl, I think there's like doubling or tripling of pressure, because you understand sort of that whole, you know, I mean, for me in particular, the Confucian background of, you know, try and grow these like intelligent, benevolent, you know, men in your family. And if you're not a man, how do I achieve that, because I'm female, but I still have to achieve that because I'm a child of a Confucian father. But, you know, like it's kind of juggling, what are men's roles, what are females' roles in a family, how do we succeed in all those Confucian values while being female? And so you've got all these like, you know, weird expectations from your parents that, you know, you've got to do better than the boys do, you've got to win all the prizes, you've got to speak all the languages, you've got to do all the instruments. But then, like, when I got married into a really traditional Asian family, it was like, why aren't you making every dish from scratch? Why are you working outside the home? So I think for a lot of girls, it's really confusing, because you're raised as boys, you know, until the point where you get married and have children. And then all of a sudden it's like, why aren't you in the house? You know, it's, you know, preparing the galangal from scratch, boiling the chicken at the, you know, at the crack of dawn. And it's really hard for us, I think. Like, I don't think you can possibly satisfy everything in your life. It's just not possible. And especially if you're marrying to an Asian family that's sort of like bound by those traditions as well. You've kind of got the rules that you were brought up with, and then you've got new rules that your, you know, parents-in-law impose on you. So it's pretty hard, I think.
Do you think these traditional values are like have stemmed from Asian culture within Asia itself? And do you think it's still like these traditional values are still really prevalent in Asian societies? Or is this lifestyle and this way of thinking outdated and, you know, different in like a Western context?
It's tricky because I think with every wave of migration from Asia, I think you sort of still have that, you know, strict traditional thing happening. And so I think the further away you are from that point of migration, and I always say this to people that I know, I think when you migrate to a different country, like from an Asian country to a Western country, I think the values that you brought with you are fairly crystallized. And so for my in-laws, for example, they still do things the way they would have done, you know, in China in the 50s and 60s. And so we're still, you know, like I think tomorrow we're going to the cemetery to, you know, clean the graves and put the offerings down. That kind of stuff, they have done that, you know, consistently since they arrived here in the, you know, early 60s or whatever. So I think with the migration experience, I think you just kind of carry everything with you and you impose that on your children at that point.
Yeah.
I think the more that your children are here or that they're in a different environment, you know, a lot of that stuff will loosen up or it will change because you have to adapt it to the environment that you're in. But I think possibly because, you know, Asian migration comes in waves, I think we're still going to be sort of dealing with these issues for years and years to come.
Yeah, with the whole migration experience, like what you said, they carry over these values and they're crystallized in their, you know, behaviors and way of thinking. And it's interesting because sometimes, like for example, my parents, they've held all these traditional values and they get a sense of culture shock when they go back to Vietnam and they've
loosened up. Yeah, it's probably more modern.
Yeah, it's become a lot more modern and it shocks them. They're like, oh wow, you guys have changed completely. It's not,
yeah.
You know, our way of living as Vietnamese people is so different from the way how it actually is in Vietnam now. And yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we're growing up in a Western society and we have all these different Western values. So we have to figure out the balance between mixing that in with our traditional values that we've been raised with our parents, and then finding the sweet spot between the two that makes us comfortable enough, but also, you know, lets us be comfortable with our Asian identity or cultural respect side of it, but also at the same time having that Western freedom, I guess.
Yeah, it's really hard. And I think that sweet spot moves around all the time. And, you know, I think, I mean, for me, it, like, I'm almost 50 and I'm still pushing back against stuff, which is just frankly ridiculous. So, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, you can't eat that food after you've had surgery or a visit to the hospital. It's like, but why? There's no scientific basis for it. Like, why are you telling me I can't eat pineapple? Because there's no, I can't, you know, until you show me the proof, I'm just going to eat that pineapple, right? So there's all this kind of stuff that, you know, unfortunately this is what they did when they came. And so it hasn't evolved. But like you say, you go back overseas and like I went to China the other day, the other year, like before COVID. And it was just so amazingly, you know, futuristic. So people were just like, you know, things like Alipay and, you know, stuff like that that, you know, we don't even have access to in Australia. Like people are just dropping cash left and right with their mobile or their watch or their whatever. And all that kind of stuff and even the way that they, you know, do their sort of respectful traditions has really evolved as well. So I can't imagine, you know, half of Shanghai going to the cemetery and actually physically doing, you know, the cleaning kind of thing. They must have other ways of doing their traditions now, but that's what you cling to when you move to another country. This is how we've always done it, to be in touch with the people that we used to be in another place. We have to keep doing this thing. So, yeah, it's interesting. I think that sweet spot, unfortunately, just has to, especially for women, shift around a lot. You just have to say, hang on a second, that's just illogical. I'm just going to, like, try and do some of that, but I'm not going to do all of it. I talk about this a little bit in the children's book I just wrote, which has that migrant focus on it. I think, unfortunately, for a lot of Asian women as well, there's an element of cultural control built into the way that, you know, men and women have been brought up that gets replicated silently without anyone ever really looking at it too hard. And so I think, you know, for a lot of, I mean, you guys are way younger than me, but for my mother's generation, for example, there's very much an element of an invisible leash happening. You know, women can only do certain things. You know, women aren't allowed to rock the boat too much. Women are controlled in certain ways, you know, for example, through finances or through the things that they're allowed to do outside the home.
Mm.
And so for me, like that is a very dangerous thing that I'm often pushing back on, because I'm saying to, you know, the women in the generation above me, but why do you do it like this? Why are you, you know, why are you too afraid to go out and get a new telephone without getting your husband's permission? Why are you doing that? So I think it will change. You know, the more the Asian diaspora lives in different countries outside the source countries, I suppose, it will hopefully change a bit. But I still see, like for a lot of migrant and refugee families, that the females are very much, you know, under the thumb of or under the coercive control of fathers, brothers, uncles, you know, that kind of thing. So that for me is a really dangerous thing that I think, you know, even though it can be sometimes really fraught with danger, I think Asian females really have to stand up to that kind of like insidious stuff that isn't spoken about.
Yeah, it's very patriarchal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Patriarchal system. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's the thing, because Western feminism doesn't speak to, you know, intersectional or migrant or refugee women necessarily, because it assumes that, you know, you've got enough agency.
You've got a choice.
Yeah, exactly. You can leave your house to have a march for justice, right? But like a lot of like migrant women, they'd love to go marching, but they can't leave home. So, you know, for me, it's really, I think it's up to us as, you know, like first generation, second generation or beyond Asian women in a different context. Like it's really up to us to say, I challenge, you know, what's happening with my grandmother. I challenge what's happening with my aunt. I challenge what's happening with my mother. Because if you don't challenge those things, the thinking will never shift and their lot will never get better. So, yeah, I think that's a big project for us. I think the diaspora of females especially should challenge that kind of, you know, controlling power kind of patriarchal thing that we've brought from the old countries to the new countries.
And you're so right, and I never thought of it that way. But, yeah, the Western sense of feminism doesn't really take into account the way that Asian countries or other cultures experience that inequality, because it's so deeply rooted into not only the society, but it, like there's so many cultural nuances that have been around for so long, it's hard to then, like, I guess it takes a lot of courage. It takes even more courage to have to stand up to these systems. So, yeah, it's definitely something that I never thought of, but it's so true. Like, there is such a difference between the Asian way of thinking and the Western way of thinking, especially about something like feminism, which is so important. Like, just fighting for equality is so important.
Yeah, it's really hard because I think we're coming from a place where, you know, like we haven't had generations of liberated women burning their bras in the street. Like we just haven't had that whole, you know, shift of thinking. And so for people to say that feminism is one size fits all, and in my kids' book, for example, it's such a tiny shift for a woman who cannot leave home other than to take her daughter to school to get a part-time job. I mean, for her, that's like a massive shift in feminist thinking, because it's like, actually, I do have a role outside the house. I can be my own person in another context. So I think for us, it's like a really big project. I mean, we should take all the freedoms that we have, you know, living in a Western country, and actually try to apply them to the sisterhood generally. And, you know, maybe we can't liberate people outside our family, but maybe we can like liberate our mum. Like if my mum wants to buy a new car and she's got the money to do it, then go buy the damn car. You know what I mean? Like you don't need to ask for permission to do that. Just do it.
Yeah, that's something I'm trying to instill in my mum as well. There have been so many instances. It's really hard. There have been so many instances, like, you know, yeah, your mum deserves the best of everything. And there's been so many times where she's like, oh, I really like, you know, the way this purse looks. And yes, it's a bit on the pricey end, but then what is holding her back isn't the lack of financial capability.
Yeah, it's like my dad's permission. Never let me. Yeah, exactly. It's just ridiculous. Like, why? You're an adult. Why do you need permission to do that?
What we were talking about before, like these gendered stereotypes in Asia, right? Mums, and this isn't like true across the board, but largely so, like mums tend to feel such an obligation to their family and they're very selfless in the sense that she would rather put that money towards something that will benefit the entire family or benefit her kids or benefit her husband over herself.
Yeah.
Like it's this culture and like these stereotypes where it's like the family comes before yourself.
Yeah, at all times. And I think that's, you know, like for Han Chinese culture, especially. I mean, that, you know, the Analects just have no place for women in them at all. I mean, I think there's like three examples. One is be good to your parents. I mean, you know, it doesn't even say be good to your mother. It's be good to your parents as a unit. The other one is, I think, you know, women are lumped in with servants because they are, you know, they're just there to serve people. And then the third example was, I think Confucius said to one of his men, who said, oh, you know, that minister's got 10 advisors and one of them's a woman. And then, you know, Confucius says, well, that's not an advisor because it's a woman. So I think for us, you know, we've built families and societies and governments on the kind of thinking that women are there to support. And so it takes that kind of, you know, like in the Western culture, people laugh about how mums will eat the burnt lamb chop, right? She'll take the one that's ugly and eat that, and like the rest of the family can have the pretty food. But I think with Asian culture, we take that to the, you know, the infinite degree where the woman is really just there to breed the children, raise the good children and get out of the way and just be silent, be supportive, and not really think about herself as a person who needs anything because she's really just there to support. So, I mean, it's that kind of thinking, which is, it's really sad because, like, I, you know, in my own husband's family, like his grandmother, my children's great-grandmother, she's 100 and she's very much still with it. And she's, you know, got all the marbles, sharp as a tack, remembers everyone's birthdays. But, I mean, the amazing thing is she's got male children and female children, and she's got male grandchildren and female grandchildren, and the males always get preference. So, you know, whether it's extra money or extra gifts or, you know, give them permission to do that, or I allow it, it's the men who get. And even though she's female and she's come, you know, from her own line of women, it's like the men in the family, because they carry the surname, they get the most, which is a really, you know, that's an ingrained way of thinking. And you know, if we keep carrying that forward, then all our women will always be sort of like on that invisible leash forever, because we just never challenge that kind of thinking. And so that to me is like the most dangerous part of it. Like I, you know, I'm a really respectful person. I'm very filial. But what really frustrates me is when someone says, tell your son to do that. And I'm like, no, tell all my children to do that, because it's equal for all of them. Like we treat them the same. So, yeah, that kind of thing I really always challenge.
This episode is brought to you by Scoopy Milk Bar.
Scoopy is a Melbourne-based dessert brand that currently specialises in deliciously refreshing Korean bingsu. It's our go-to dessert place that has plenty of good vibes, and you know how much Tui and I love them good vibes, and so many yummy flavours to choose from.
So Tiana, tell me, what's your favourite flavour?
Well, Tui, I'm glad you asked. I do love myself some mango. It really hits the spot with a burst of mango pearls and milk mochi. And gotta love pouring in the condensed milk on that mountain of scoopy goodness. And what about yourself, Tui?
Well, my favourite has got to be taro. It's not too overly sweet, and I reckon the toppings work super well together. Like you've got taro mochi, tapioca pearls, and it's also topped with condensed milk too. But yeah, it's awesome how Scoopy was founded by fellow Aussie Asians who wanted to spread their Asian heritage and upbringing through food.
So we have a cheeky discount code for you guys. All you need to do is use UA15 at the checkout for 15% off in the month of April. That's right, 15% off their entire menu using the discount code UA15. Thank you so much, Scoopy, for giving our listeners a lovely Scoopy discount.
Another thing I come to a realization is I also want to challenge the men, or like, you know, I should be challenging my dad to change his values as well. Like, for example, with the purse situation, right? I'm telling my mum, just go buy it and whatnot. Maybe I should go challenge my dad and say, Dad, don't put these like chains on mum. Just let her buy whatever she wants. Like, she doesn't have to ask your permission or anything, and see whether he's comfortable with that.
It's tricky though, because when you have those conversations with your parents, like I think at some Yamcha once, my dad sort of scoffed and said, oh, why does your sister always, you know, write about patriarchy? What's patriarchy anyway? And I kind of almost spat my hot tea out on the table because I thought, you've got to be one of the best examples of, you know, patriarchal upbringing. Like, you know, you can't go into it because it's personally hurtful, and they can't even see it. It's like how all they the men at the moment, they can't see it. Like in politics at the moment, the men are going, oh, I can't really understand what it's like to be a woman because I'm not a woman. And it's like, that is a massive failure of empathy, right? But I think it's just as hard in a really patriarchal sort of like upbringing where you go, you know, I'm really challenging the way you brought me up because I think parts of it were really wrong. And to tell someone you're close to that, it's like you're speaking in a different language to them. All of a sudden they've gone deaf and they can't hear you, right?
100%.
I cannot understand the words that are coming out of your mouth, right? So it's really, really hard to do. I completely understand it. It's it's kind of like taking the chains off your dad as well as off your mum, because mm-hmm. you're saying to them, I need you to see the world in a different way. And it's a really difficult conversation to have. Is.
Yeah, fights with parents all the time.
Yeah, me too. They're like, they think I'm the most difficult child. I'm the eldest child. And so like, I'm the one who's always challenged them. Like, I've got a really good sister who went and did medicine and did all that stuff. So she's perfect, right? She just never challenged anything. And then I've got the youngest one who, like my youngest sister is a visual artist. And so my parents have no framework for that whatsoever. They can't even understand what that means. Like, how do you earn money from that? Like, you make videos about yourself? What does that mean? So, you know, like for me, like I've constantly always said, I don't understand why we do it this way. And so like I've always been branded the really difficult daughter, but I just can't, you know, whenever I see it, I can't stand it, and I sort of say it.
Oh my God, everything you guys are saying, I'm like, oh my God, yes. And it's a cycle, right? It's like you see a certain behavior or you hear a comment that's made that isn't right by you or isn't right by your values, because you think, well, that's just, you know, very patriarchal, or that's a very old school way of thinking, and then you say something and then your parents are like, stop talking back, we didn't raise you like this, why are you so rude? And then you're like, look, I just am just my own person, I'm trying to stand up for myself and stand up for, you know, what I believe in. It doesn't mean that I'm like a rebel child, it just means that I think what you're doing doesn't align with what I believe in. And and I think a lot of the time family members tend to want to silence you. They kind of link silence with respect in a way, where it's like, well, if you step out of line or if you voice your opinion, you're not being respectful and you're not, you know, showing that you're a good daughter, or you're not showing that you're a good sister.
Yeah, you're not obedient enough. I know it's tricky, because like, you know, my dad kind of said sadly the other day, you know, I should have talked to you more when you were younger. And then, you know, that's the thing. It's like, you didn't want us to talk back, so we wouldn't have talked to you more. You know, there's no, like if I'd said to you, oh, I don't agree with that, you would have just probably hit me over the head with a rolled up newspaper, right? So it's like, I think the way you need to say it to your parents now is like, I'm not being disrespectful. I'm just trying to have a conversation with you. Because my dad's really regretful now. He's like, I never really got to know you as people. And it's like, it's almost too late, because all those years where I was trying to go, but why, you know, just explain to me, but why, you didn't want to hear it, or you actually shut it down. So it's like almost too late now to say, you know, those almost 50 years of opinions I had, here they all are. It's really, really hard to actually just go dump, there you go, that's what I think, you know, and like completely, you'd at that point be at loggerheads, like you disagree about everything. So yeah, it's just hard. I think for you, because you guys have obviously got more time, you can just say, I'm just trying to talk to you. Like, I just want to understand where you're coming from, and I want you to understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, it's all about your approach, right? Like, otherwise feel like parents feel like they're being attacked.
Yeah.
In a sense, or it's really tricky.
I mean, that's the thing, like, you know, my new book, I can't actually show my parents. Like, they've kind of said, can we have a copy? And I've thought, well, I pretty much take apart that whole upbringing that I had, so maybe I better not show you, because you might get a little bit hurt, you know what I mean? And like, even my father-in-law, like, he always says, I don't want to read anything you've written, not interested. But then for this one, because he realized there was like kind of an Asian perspective to it, he was like, can I have a copy? And I said to my husband, can I give him a copy? And he's like, no, don't give him a copy. So it's really hard, because it really is like, it's like I'm full on taking apart 2,500 years of philosophy. You sure you're ready for it? Because I'm doing it, right? It's in print. So yeah, it is really hard. Like, I don't think I can ever really have that conversation with them now, because it's me saying to them, I challenge you to defend the way that I was brought up, and I challenge you to, you know, defend all the ways that you think about men's roles and women's roles. Go for your life. You know, and it's a really hard conversation to have. It's like, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I want you to explain it to me, and that's really hard.
The concept of change and growth for them is really hard, especially at an older age.
Because it's that whole clinging to the thing that you brought with you, you know, that your sense of self is so sort of, you know, it's entwined with, you know, what you brought when you came over and the person you were when you came over and all the struggles you've been through because you were that person. And so for them, you know, your children to turn around and go, oh, well, you probably could have done it a little bit differently, is a really challenging concept, I think. And, you know, change is hard for anybody, even without all that superstructure of being Asian or, you know, having all this stuff that you're carrying across. Like, without being migrant or Asian, it's already really hard to change. So add all this other stuff into the mix and it's, like, almost impossible, probably.
So the novel you're talking about is Tiger Daughter, right? Mm-hmm. You did touch on it before, but would you say that this book is almost like a autobiography to a certain degree?
No, I mean, the thing is, it's not, and I've been really careful to say this everywhere, it's not autobiographical because, you know, the parents in the book are not my parents, the girl is not me. And so, I grew up pretty poor in the beginning, but we've been lucky, you know, we worked hard, we did the sort of, you know, model minority thing, and we sort of saved and we, you know, worked hard and sort of bought houses and all that kind of thing. But the thing that the book is, I guess, autobiographical about is the feeling of being a migrant. So that whole feeling of just, you know, being in sort of moments of like, you know, complete unsafety or toxicity or danger or, you know, like hopelessness. Like, I'm just sort of saying to kids in that situation, I can see how you feel, because I used to feel that way myself. And, you know, eventually, even though it's really hard and you have to do some work changing, it gets better. And so it's not really an autobiographical story, because I never went through the things that main character Wynne went through, and I never lived in that suburb, and, you know, I never sort of went to a school like that. But that feeling of being completely unsafe and suffocated and unhappy and thinking, is life ever going to change? Like, those moments are very real, I think. And there's a bit in the book where she's followed on the street by, you know, this teenage girl is followed on the street by two white guys in the dark. I mean, that happened to me. So sort of working that feeling of, you know, physically being unsafe as a girl, but also physically being unsafe as an Asian girl, into that book was really important.
For those that haven't had the pleasure of reading your novel, can you please give everyone a bit of a taste of what Tiger Daughter is all about?
Sure. It's going to sound sort of massively unappealing, I think, but it was aimed at a sort of like 10 to 14 year old audience. So that sort of cusp of moving from primary school to senior school and sort of your life beginning to hopefully open up a bit. But it was kind of, it's trying to do a few things at once. One, it's trying to critique the Confucian Analects, and that's sort of not really appealing to 10-year-olds. So they're not seeing that meta project in there, possibly, but I was trying to give some context to why her home life felt so sort of unsafe for her. But it's also sort of dealing with a girl who comes from, you know, a really poor background, whose real only hope, I suppose, is to try and pass the entrance exam to a selective school somewhere else, so that, you know, maybe one day her life will have opportunities. And the book is really also a study of friendship. So often in a lot of like YA and MG novels, there's that hint of romance. So people are always trying to like shoehorn a romance in there, a coming of age romance story. But for me, it was really important to just say, I've got a boy who's in danger and I've got a girl who's in danger, and they are just friends.
Yeah.
So they kind of understand each other. They come from slightly different, you know, Chinese cultural backgrounds, but they're both very poor. They're both struggling. Their lives have no joy in it whatsoever. And what they're hoping to do with this entrance exam is to bring, you know, like engineer, I suppose, some joy in their future lives.
I wish when I was growing up and I went to the library, I would find books like this on the shelf, because I think it's really cool to see not your exact story reflected in a book, but kind of see a part of your culture or see a part of yourself or understand that there's a lot of people that go through these experiences. And hopefully the young kids that read these books can have more empathy when they're older as well, and that can kind of help with what we were talking about before, which is changing those values that have been ingrained in us for so long, or understanding even the migrant story even a bit more, because I think it's all about understanding, right? Because at the end of the day, it's just humanity that we really are looking at. It's yes, we have differences, but we're all the same, we're all human. So I think it's really awesome that you've aimed this at an audience that they're at an age where they're really going through an identity search. So I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, I think I'm also trying to catch those kids, I guess, you know, like the ones who are sort of standing outside Asian culture and othering us, and say to them, before you start calling someone a Ching Chong Chinaman or whatever it is you're going to do, before you start getting to that point in your life where you, you know, start treating people discriminatorily, why don't you kind of try and walk in someone else's shoes for a while and see what it feels like? Because, like, it was interesting. I had another interview earlier on where the interviewer, who was Caucasian, he said, I went to a selective school and, you know, the Asian kids didn't really mix with us. I had my group and there was the Asian group. And I said, you know, shift in perspective here. The Asian kids in your school, they're just like you, trying to get through selective school, all the pressure, but they're just Asian. Like, you know, we're all trying to do the same thing, but there's nothing freaky about it. You know, you could have gone over and spoken to them because they would have been going through the same stuff as you were, but from a slightly different cultural context, that's all. So it's just shifting that thinking of we're not all other people, we're just people. And we've all got stories, and our stories may not be the same as yours, but we still have stories and they're still valuable.
There was one part in your book, it was about the main character, Wen. So she gets invited to a party, but she isn't able to go because her dad said no. And that was such a common experience I had growing up, where I'd get invited to outings and get-togethers with my friends, but a majority of time I could not go because simply my parents said no.
Yeah.
And their reasoning was like, oh, you have to stay home, you study, going out is bad for you, blah, blah, blah. And to them, they thought me saying no all the time, like I told them it's because my parents said no.
Yeah.
My parents said no.
But they think there's something wrong with you, or you don't like them, or, you know, that you're a princess or whatever. And that's the thing. Like, I tried to get that feeling of, I think for a lot of kids growing up in mainstream Australian culture, they can do whatever they like, right? Like we're coming from the perspective of our parents are trying to make sure we get through school in a really good way and we're safe. And so especially for women, it's like you stay home because the world is unsafe. You know, you are not allowed to go out. It's distracting. There are bad things out there. And so I think for us, that whole element of control, and, you know, there's a lot of control in this book. So it's critiquing that, you know, element of how can I be a child and have a fun life, but also be safe and also not be subject to control. That means I say no to everything, and that people have a bad perspective of me because I say no to everything.
By showing the Asian experience and upbringing through this book, hopefully people who aren't Asian or haven't been brought up in an Asian household, once they read it, they kind of get the idea of where, you know, why perhaps their Asian friends can't go out as often, and then understand or have that empathy, like, okay, that it's not, you know, it's not the friend's fault that they can't go out and stuff, and be more understanding that way.
There's this whole superstructure sitting on top of that friend that won't let them leave the house. That's the thing. And also, like, you know, even the way you dress, I mean, I'm sure your parents have said to you before, you can't go out looking like that, right? So, you know, it's down to the minute detail of when you do go out, you've got to represent your culture in a certain way too. So there's all this stuff that I think, you know, lots of kids who just go, well, I just threw on this Manky tee and these pair of, you know, short shorts and just headed out. And it's like, you know, even it's calibrated down to the way you look when you go out. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to think about. And so, like, I think I was just trying to say to children, look at the kid next to you in class. Maybe he's quiet and maybe he's antisocial and maybe he doesn't do certain things because of all this extra stuff that you can't see. But you should be aware that there is all this extra stuff that you can't see, and you should be, you know, open to asking him about it, or, you know, just starting a conversation about why is your life so different from mine, and just getting people to, you know, empathize with the kid next to them. You know, don't bully them. Ask them why they're like that. Ask them why they don't have enough lunch. Ask them why their trousers are too short. Find out about them, because you can be sure that there's stuff going on in their life that you have no idea about.
Well, Rebecca, I just wanted to tie this up with a question that really underpins the heart and soul of our podcast. Mm-hmm. So when we first started, it was all about creating a space where people feel like they can be seen and they can be heard. So we really wanted to ask you, what makes you unapologetically Asian?
I think what makes me really unapologetically Asian is, one, I look like the quintessential Asian lady. So, like, on the street, like, I get a lot of people coming up to me going, don't I know you from somewhere? Because I look like everyone's Asian friend, or, you know, everyone's Asian aunt or something. So I think I just look really Asian. But also, like, I think, I mean, the way that I think and the way that I speak and the things that I stand up for, my cultural background is kind of at the heart of everything. It's almost like, I mean, coming up through law in the you know, 90s and early 2000s, it wasn't a super Asian place to work. And so the fact that I would, you know, get into my little suit every day and trot out there and just, you know, be the shy Asian lady who actually did stuff in a really scary patriarchal white workplace, like just being in those spaces, I think makes me unapologetically Asian. It's like, you don't want to have me in this boardroom, which was not built for people like me, but hey, I'm here and you can't make me cry, right? So I think, you know, the fact that you go out every day and you're like, I'm going to strap on my lawyer shoes now and frigging be a lawyer in a white workplace, you know, that for me is, yeah, it's hard. Like every day it's difficult. Oh my God, I've got to talk to these people. It's so hard to talk to people, but you just do it. And that just makes you absolutely unapologetically Asian, I think. Just getting out there and doing it, which is what you guys are doing as well, you know, making a space for yourself where you aren't necessarily welcome.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for your time. It's been, it's honestly been such an informative interview. Like, I've learned so much from chatting with you, and you're super insightful.
Oh, thank you guys. No, I mean, I completely understand where you guys are coming from. I mean, that's the beauty of being able to speak to, you know, Asian interviewers, because it's like you completely get the context. Like, you don't have to explain all those extra layers, because like you, like in your workplaces every day, you're coming from the same place as well. It's like, I've got to go into these spaces that weren't made for me and, you know, like outbrazen everyone, even though I wasn't raised to do that. So it's hard. Like every time you strap on your armor and you go out, it is really difficult, but you know, you just do it.
For sure. Even speaking loudly is just, it's uncomfortable.
I know. Like even like speaking in public still, you know, like I'm so old now and I still have trouble getting up and saying stuff in front of people. It's like, I'm beating myself up inside my head going, why is it so difficult? But you've got all these decades of conditioning, right, to deal with. Because, you know, like even your parents don't want to hear from you. It's like, I don't want to hear that because it's rude, right? So if your parents don't want to hear from you, having to get up and speak in front of, you know, 13 hostile men, like how's that going to be comfortable, right? So it's just really hard. Like it's all these extra layers of, I've really got to get my mental armor on today because I've got to do this thing that, one, it's hard for me already, but two, it's doubly hard because of the context.
What you did was break through that bamboo ceiling.
Oh, I don't know if I've broken through it yet, but I'm just kind of sticking my fingernails in there and trying to prise it apart. So we'll just, yeah. All you can do is like, you know, every Asian woman who goes out there into a workplace that isn't that welcoming, all of us are doing it. Like we're all just trying to crowbar aside a little bit of space for us to sort of make our way without being held down by things.
We hope you enjoyed that discussion that we had with Rebecca. We both learned so much from the insightful discussion. And we hope you did too, and that you could relate to some of the things that we spoke about. If you liked this episode, please remember to follow or subscribe to us on your favorite podcasting platform. We're on the Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon, CastBox, and everything else that you can think of. We also have a website where you can check out our episodes as well, www.unapologeticallyasian.com.au.
You can also find us on the socials. We're mainly on Instagram, and our Insta handle is unapologeticallyAZN. Thank you again for listening. We'll catch you guys in the next episode.
Saying love and good vibes. Bye.
Bye.